tonight on Arena. Gaelan Dorsey on playing bass and duetting with David Bowie, and pianist John O'Connor on Beethoven. Renowned bassist and vocalist Gaelan Dorsey is set to take the stage in Dublin this week for special performances at the Dublin Bowie Festival, joining forces with the RT Concert Orchestra to celebrate the music of the late icon. Known for her decade-long tenure in David Bowie's band, Dorsey became a fan favourite for her powerful rendition of Under Pressure and her unmistakable bass lines in some of Bowie's most celebrated tours. Beyond Bowie, she has collaborated with major artists including Tears for Fears, Lenny Kravitz and The National, solidifying her reputation as one of the most sought-after musicians in the industry. Ahead of her performances, I'm delighted to welcome Gaelan Dorsey into studio. You're so welcome, Gaelan.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Now, I know you have been in Ireland a number of times.
I have indeed.
Performing. But if you wouldn't mind, could we go back to Philadelphia and how you discovered music and how you discovered the bass guitar?
Well, I you know, growing up in Philadelphia in the late 60s, early 70s, I was born in 1962. So, there was just so much music around in those days, just in my neighborhood and in my household. Even though I'm the only one of my four other siblings that plays music, but they had amazing record collections, and I was hearing guitar players specifically because that was the first instrument I started with. Terry Kath from the band Chicago, of course, Jimi Hendrix, Eric Clapton from Cream. Brian May from Queen. Guitar was just like this incredible instrument, and I just thought I really want to speak that language, and I ended up getting a guitar for my 9th birthday, and I taught myself to play because I still have not had any formal musical training. I don't know how to read music. I don't know music theory and harmony and those things. I learned bits and pieces along the way, but I really don't know it like others who really study music. So I guess at this point I realized I had a gift for it, and I just taught myself, play by ear. And bass came to me when I was 14 because I had been playing guitar with some kids in the neighborhood with a local band, just playing for fun. You know, we weren't making any money or anything. But I had it in my head that I wanted to play. I was good enough at this point, at 14, that I wanted to join a band that was actually making money. So I went looking for a job in the summer break between school. And all of the advertisements for musicians were guitar players who were looking for bass players, particularly bass players. They were drummers, yeah, keyboard players. But it seemed like in 1974 or 75 or whenever that was, everybody played the guitar. It was like the most popular instrument. So I thought, well, you know, bass is only four strings. I played around on one once. It wasn't so difficult. Maybe I'll just, I said to my mother, I'm going to borrow a bass. I'm going to go on an audition. There was one band that said, Top 40, we have work for the summer, you know, Sweet 16 birthday parties and, you know, whatever kind of clubs and whatnot. And I went I borrowed a bass, I got the job. And so I played bass that summer. But I didn't take it seriously really until I was about 20. Then I was like, yeah, I think bass is calling me more than
And
the
do you still play guitar?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've started doing, I'm working on a solo album now again, first one in 20 years. And I've been doing, last year I started doing a bunch of solo shows in the States. So, and I play guitar in my shows. And bass as well, but mainly guitar.
We'll move on to 1995 and mm-hmm. that life-changing moment, really.
Yes.
When you got a call, somebody telling you that David Bowie had been looking for you.
That's right. I was working, I had just been on tour with Tears for Fears at that time, like you mentioned. On the Elemental tour, and we'd done Raoul and the Kings of Spain, and And I was working on a solo project then with Roland Orzabal from Tears for Fears. And I was at his studio in the south of England, southwest England. And that's where the phone call came. His wife at the time took the call in the house in the kitchen. I remember her running across the yard from the house to the studio where we could see her through the glass doors, you know. And they had a young baby at the time. And she was like pale, you know. We were like, oh my God, what's happened? And she opens the door and she says, David Bowie just called. I just picked up the phone in the kitchen. I nearly dropped the baby. I'll never forget that. And she said, I've given him the number of the studio. He's going to call in 5 minutes. So we all sat there, you know, on pins and needles. And sure enough, the phone rings and I went into the office and took the call. And first, I didn't think it was him. I'd lived in London for 12 years, so I didn't think I thought it was a friend from London playing a trick on me.
And then you subsequently found out how he found you, and he found you watching television.
Watching telly, that's what he said to me. It took me a couple of years to have the courage to ask him why he actually called me, because I felt like he could have had any bass player in the world. I can't imagine anyone would want to turn that job down. But he he said to me he was watching telly in a hotel in London at some point, and it would have to have been around 1989, which is when my first solo album came out, The Corporate World, which I came here to do a show at the Bagot Inn. I don't know if that place still exists, but I remember touring that album, and I came to play in Dublin. But he saw me on some music show in London, I guess. I don't know which one. He said that I played a song and I talked to the host and I played another song. And then he said to himself, this woman is very interesting. And when I have the right project going, I would love to work with her. So somehow, 6 years later, which is a testament to his memory, and which now in retrospect, I know what a sharp mind he did have to remember me from that moment. And 6 years later to then call me. But he also probably had done a bunch of research in between that time as to what I was doing and what, you know, how my career was evolving.
And what was the offer? Was the offer to join the band?
Was to join the band for the Outside tour with Nine Inch Nails. He had done the album, the Outside album. He sent it to me on a cassette. It's so funny. It was back, that's so far ago. I remember getting the album on a cassette to hear it. And it was because it wasn't released yet. And then he said, it's going to be 6 weeks. We're going with Nine Inch Nails. It's going to be like a kind of show where we morph into each other. It's not like no one's really the headliner, but it's like this kind of event. And I would love you. Carlos Alomar's in the band, Reeves Gabrel, like all these names that I'd seen on Bowie album covers. I was so nervous. I just thought, I can't. I'm going to be in a band with Carlos Alomar? Like, to me, that was like huge.
You can't say no.
I couldn't say no, because I said to Roland when I came out of from the phone call, he said, well, what did he say? What did he say? And I said, well, he says he wants me to go on tour with him, but it'll be 6 weeks and I can come back to our project. And I said, well, how do you feel about that? And he's like, well, it's Bowie. You got to go. He was right. You know, you just got to go. You don't say, no, I can't do it. But sadly, I never got back to finishing what I was working on with Roland, because I always wondered what that would have turned out to be. But
Because once you joined up with Bowie, he kept you on board.
It didn't stop. It morphed straight from the Outside tour. It went into the Earthling years. So that was the first album I actually played on with Bowie, was Earthling. Because as soon as Outside was finished, they were already working on new material and called me into the studio for that. And then that just became the tour. And then that...
Now, there's so many standout moments from your time with Bowie. Mm. And I suppose one of the biggest challenges for you was when he asked you to duet with him.
Absolutely.
On Under Pressure.
Absolutely.
So can you, we're going to play it. We're going to play the version that was played live with you and Bowie in Dublin. But maybe bring us into that, because he didn't want you only to play the bass. He wanted you to sing.
To sing it, yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, initially, I remembered at some point during the Nine Inch Nails tour, the Outside tour, he came into my dressing room and said to me, what do you think about doing Under Pressure with me? And firstly, Queen are my favorite band of all time. And I've seen them probably live more than any band that I've seen in my lifetime when I was a teenager. It's all the early tours with Freddie. And so that in itself was like, like, what? Are you kidding me? There's no way. But then he said, you know, I did it with Annie Lennox at Freddie's tribute. And I said, yes, I was there. I saw it. I was still living in London at the time. And that was amazing because I'm a huge Annie Lennox fan. So I thought, okay, great. But who's going to, I'll sing it with you like Annie, but who's going to play the bass? And he just said, you are. And I was like, I didn't know what to say, but I just remember him giving me that cheeky little grin of his and saying, I'll give you 2 weeks. And he just sort of grinned and walked out of the room.
So neither of those tasks are easy, are
neither,
they?
Neither are easy. No, not at all. And I for 2 weeks, I went to work. I just started drilling it. I started it slow. That's one of my tricks of singing and playing bass at the same time is taking whatever piece of music it is and putting on a metronome to count the time and slowing the song down as slow as possible and playing it together with the singing and the bass as slow as possible. It's weird that somehow my brain can then see how the pieces fit with each other. And then I slowly, slowly, slowly bring it up to speed until it locks. And then somehow it stays there. I can pull it out again. It's a weird...
Shall we have a listen?
It's weird. Yes, let's do it.
Go, girl. Pressure. Gaylan Dorsey. Gaylan, lovely Dorsey.
Oh, it's chillingly beautiful. And I know,
wow.
I think we've upset you, Gaylan.
No,
I'm so sorry.
It's happy tears, don't worry.
You wow, taking on Freddie Mercury's part there,
yes.
And just rocking it.
Well, you know, and just think that both of them are not with us now and just how much I love both of those artists so much. And the thing about that performance, which is I did that song, I don't know, hundreds of times with him over the years on tour, but by a stroke of great luck and that performance at the point was captured. And it's like, to me, I that's the best version I've ever done for myself, I remember. And every time I would do that song, I would look out at the lights and I would think of Freddie, first and foremost, just before we started, and I would just ask him to give me what I need to do it right for him.
And looking at the footage from that performance on YouTube, I mean, it's such a loving relationship between you.
Yeah, we had fun. We had a lot of fun on stage. And I appreciate him for giving me that connection and giving me that space and that kind of platform and making me feel comfortable. And in a lot of ways, really teaching me how to be a performer on stage. Just sort of, it was such a, just working with him was like having the opportunity to study under a great, great master.
Yes, but you can see the harmony and the one voice goes up, then the other, goes beyond. It's a wonderful,
wow,
beautiful mastery from both of you.
He's such a great singer. To me, of his genre of artists, of male vocalists in rock or pop or whatever, it's hard to categorize him really. I think he is definitely the ultimate of the vocalists, of the singers, of his peers. So to sing with him is just unbelievable. It's like getting to sing with Sinatra or something.
Did you know that night in Dublin that ye had really cracked it, both of you?
No, not really. Every night I would think I hope it's good, you know. But I just know that show particularly I remember was just a phenomenal show. Most shows in Ireland are fantastic. This country loves music and it's such a beautiful thing. And it's, I love anybody who loves music.
Now, they're the stage performances. What was it like then in the recording studio? Like, was he somebody who knew what he wanted?
He knew what he wanted, but he also, it was also kind of opened up like it was like a playground. It was like school, like play school. I don't know how, I felt like he would really, he always invited all of the musicians to contribute an idea. It was never, no one was like off limits, because he always got excited by ideas.
And how would he bring an idea? Would he play something and sing something, or had he had something written down?
Yeah, he would have some recordings of a little bit of something he'd done at home, a guitar line he could play, or some kind of piano riff, or he would work with Reeves Gabrels or some other, or Jerry Leonard or whatever, and they would come up with some pieces. And then he would bring what he had, and we would kind of contribute to that and start building from there. I think he would always know ultimately when to stop and what he wanted to hear. But he didn't come in and say, do that, I want to hear that. But he would know when it was finished. Which to me is a great, better way to working in some ways, because it doesn't limit you to your own head, in a sense.
Now, the Bowie Festival here is such a celebration of David Bowie, and a wonderful chance for us to meet musicians who played with him, like you. And the band is all together, except for the man himself, obviously.
That's right. Yes.
So what can people look forward to at the Bowie Festival
with
your involvement?
Oh, well, I'm going to just be singing. I think I'm playing bass on a couple of things, but for the most part, I'm doing vocals on a few songs. I don't know if I'm allowed. I guess I'm allowed to say what they are.
I think you are.
Yeah, I'll be doing Loving the Alien, Life on Mars, Space Oddity, Win. And I think I'm playing bass on Fame, and Let's Dance.
And what'll it be? Have you got together with the band members in the past?
I have not. Well, some of the members that are here, we do. Ever since David passed, I live in New York, and we've done a concert in New York City on his birthday weekend. So a lot of alumni from different eras of Bowie bands, from Carmine Rojas, Donnie McCaslin, Jerry Leonard, Donnie McCaslin. We all get together and play. So, but I haven't done this lineup with Mike. I haven't seen Mike Garson in a very long time, and also Sterling Campbell, who I speak to on the phone on a regular basis, but I haven't seen him lately. So I'm excited to get back to the old rhythm section. It's going to be fun.
Well, we're all looking forward to it too, and so delighted to have you here on Arena with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm so happy and grateful to be here. I'm grateful to be playing music and in honor of our dear David Bowie.
You can see Gaylan Dorsey in Whelan's tomorrow evening with her Bowie alumni ahead of their big show in the Three Arena on Sunday with the RT Concert Orchestra. Full details of all the events are on DublinBowieFestival.ie. Now, tonight on Arena's Film Reviews, we'll be talking about Pamela Anderson's big comeback, The Last Showgirl, and we'll also review the Italian wartime drama, Vermilio. But before we get to those films, let's remember the legendary actor Gene Hackman. News broke this morning of his death, along with his wife Betsy Arakawa. As you may have heard, the Santa Fe County Sheriff confirmed their bodies were found in their home, and police are still investigating. Gene Hackman, who turned 95 earlier this year, was a Hollywood legend. He won 2 Academy Awards and starred in classic films like The French Connection, Bonnie and Clyde, and Unforgiven. More recently, he was remembered for his comic turn in Wes Anderson's The Royal Tenenbaums. Justin McGregor is here to review the movies, as is Jim McRae. But Justin, you've been looking back at the career of Gene Hackman. So he regarded himself as a very unlikely leading man, but that was very much what he was, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, it was. I mean, he knew at 10 that he wanted to be an actor, but didn't see it as being in the cards, joined the army when he was 16 years old, and actually breaks quite late. Like in his 30s, he starts to do a lot of TV and then eventually lands in this part of Bonnie and Clyde, this supporting role in Bonnie and Clyde. But for him, his hero was Errol Flynn. And his thing was, I do not look like Errol Flynn. And he thought, that's a movie star. And even when he was a leading man, he would go, why are you calling me a leading man? Like, he just really couldn't accept that that's who he was. And he hated watching himself on screen, said he hated seeing him age on screen as well. So a real artist and a legend. But after that, Bonnie and Clyde and the nomination, Best Supporting Actor, he goes on to make The Conversation, you know, the Francis Ford Coppola movie. That's a fantastic psychological thriller. And within the same year, makes Young Frankenstein, the Mel Brooks comedy, and The French Connection too. And of course, it won Best Actor for the
French
Connection.
Yes, because you want to concentrate on a 12-month period that saw the releases of those key films. Will we just talk about those films a little bit, Justin? Because shows very, very different kind of Gene Hackman performances.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's what I love about them. I mean, in The Conversation, he's kind of this obsessive, paranoid bookworm who's listening to this sound and sort of piecing together this conversation, you know, through his tapes. So very kind of like All the President's Men, a really dark sort of noirish kind of film. And then his next film is Young Frankenstein, a black and white movie, Mel Brooks, Gene Wilder. Very, very funny. Very, very funny scene with him as a blind priest.
Okay, we might just play a little clip from Young Frankenstein. Here he is, indeed, the blind priest, a lonely blind priest who thinks that a young boy is coming to his door to save him from his loneliness. But in fact, unknown to the priest, because he's blind, it's the monster.
Mm. Oh, no, don't speak. Don't speak. Don't say a word. Oh, my joy and my prize from heaven. Oh, you must have been the tallest one in your class. My name is Harold, and I live here all alone. What is your name?
Mm.
I didn't get that.
Mm.
Nope. Oh, forgive me. I didn't realize you were a mute. You see how heaven plans. Me, a poor blind man, and you, a mute. An incredibly big mute.
Incredibly big. And then the other film I think you picked from that time is Get Shorty.
French Connection 2.
Oh, yes.
Where he plays Popeye Boyle. And again, here it's an action movie. It's an anti-hero. So those just those three roles in 12 months really, I think, say a lot about him. But yes, one of my favourite roles.
I just picked it because we have a clip of it and it's another very funny clip. But tell us why you like this clip so much from Get Shorty.
It's just this. Get Shorty, he plays this film producer who John Travolta's kind of grafter, debt collector shows up on. And he just has these moments in that film of such pure earnestness. And he's not really playing comedy or drama. He's just acting. And I think that's what made him so good in the comedies, like that clip there. But the scene in Get Shorty where John Travolta bursts into his house at night because the debt sort of ends with this producer. And he kind of comes to a defense of his work and who he is and does it with this kind of brilliant delivery that to this day I just love.
So, you want me to call you a cab?
So you make movies, huh?
I produce feature motion pictures, no TV. You mentioned Grotesque before. That happens to be Grotesque Part 2 that Karen Flores was in. She also starred in 3 of my Slime Creatures releases. You may have seen them.
Very funny. All right, we'll move on. Thank you very much for talking to us there, Justin, about Gene Hackman. As I said, Jim McRae is with us as well. And to our film reviews, we'll start with The Last Showgirl, which marks the renaissance of Pamela Anderson's screen career. Though this is a far cry from Baywatch, it's a grim underbelly of Las Vegas. The film tells us the story of Shelley, the star of La Razzle Dazzle. Tell us about La Razzle Dazzle.
So this is a show that's been going for decades, and Shelley Gardner is an enthusiastic 57-year-old chorus girl who has been performing this for years. She kind of has a core group of women that are also dancers that are much younger than her, that she tells about the heyday of how she was shipped all over the world, how she kind of led certain sections of it, how she was a star, and she still has such a a love for the performance, and she's dedicated her life to it. And all of this comes crashing down when she's told that, and they're all told that this is the last few days of the show, so enjoy it out. And it's going to be cancelled, and it's one of the last shows of its kind. So very much so, she's somebody who sacrificed. She was a single mother. She sacrificed her relationship with her daughter Hannah to perform in this every single night, to the point where she sacrificed relationships. It's not something that pays particularly well or has healthcare. And again, because the show has been fading in popularity, you know, new cool things have taken over. Ultimately, she doesn't have any savings. The other girls that she's worked with are starting to move on and starting to look at what's next. And she really is struggling to process this.
Let's listen to a clip which talks about that moment when Pamela Anderson as Shelley hears the terrible news from David Bautista as Eddie. We'll also hear Kieran Shipka in this clip as Jody.
Tell me what she said.
She said the new casino owners want to put their own stamp on the place. So they brought in the circus. That show's doing well, so...
I mean, who puts money into a circus that's not Cirque du Soleil, right? That's dumb.
I knew when we started sharing our theater, when they started taking over Thursday, Friday, Saturday shows, it was a bad sign.
Oh, no shit. And also, no, you did not.
Yeah, I did.
Yes. Oh, no, you guys,
didn't.
Wait.
Oh, you didn't.
You guys, yeah. Our show is legendary.
It is, but, you know, Razzle Dazzle, it's old. It's the last show of its kind on the Strip.
And if that's what makes it so special, the fact that it's the last one. It's a show. It's the costumes, the sets.
Look, it is a dinosaur, Shelley.
I think we're getting noticed tomorrow.
Are you kidding? Yeah, you heard this from Muffy?
Yeah.
Is wrong with you?
Pamela Anderson there in a clip from The Last Showgirl. Justin, this could be tailor-made from Pamela Anderson because she's been so vocal about women aging in the film industry. But in fact, it could have passed her by.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. Like she, you know, I think people forget, like at Baywatch at one point, they say 1.2 billion people were watching it a week. Like it was a massive, massive hit. And the minute sort of, I guess, the shine was off, they were all aging a little bit. It just gets cancelled and they're kind of discarded. And there was always more to Pamela Anderson than that. You know, she read Tennessee Williams. Like she was very, you know, very self-depreciating in her humor and the way she approached things. Of course, the sex tape with her husband at the time sort of, again, showed her off in that sort of light. And people didn't realize like she had who she really was. And what's amazing about this film is it's like she finally actually gets to be that person that really she's been for decades through a character who's just finding out how to be that person. So there's a very fine sliver, I think, between, you know, Shelley and Pamela Anderson. And when she talks about, you know, her love of being on stage, but also how you just get discarded, there's something so intimate about those statements that it really just resonates. It's a magnificent performance, very similar to Demi Moore in The Substance too, about, you know, what's going on about women and aging and the consequence and what it means for an industry that does discard so easily.
Yes, and I think it was her son found the script, came to him by a circuitous route where her agent had previously rejected it. You would wonder what relationship, I think he's her ex-agent now, had with the star.
Yeah, so she, Ed Giacopoulos said that she submitted to the agent and it was cancelled within 1 hour. So she went and sought out her son, who immediately loved it, brought it to Pamela, who then loved it. And yeah, as a result, like went on board. And I think one of the, if you watch her interviews about this, it's so powerful. She really was so excited to get this part and that she found a part like that no one had given her the opportunity. And this is her first like proper film and in a proper role. And that she's just ironically, as her character is, you know, lost and rudderless and, you know, doesn't have a space, like this is a whole new range for
and
Pamela's
career.
And
do you think that Gia Coppola always had it in mind that this was going to be a Pamela Anderson project if she could get it to her?
She sought her out. So that's why she didn't let up when it was a no. And like that, it wasn't an auditioning for the role. She was asking her for the part. So one of the things they both said is she brought it to Pamela and Pamela said, I can do this. And Gia said, no, I'm asking you to do this. I'm trying to sell you on this project. So it was very much so there from the get-go. And they seemed to form a real creative bond and a real trust because there's so much in that that was found between the pair of them.
Let's listen to another clip. This is a scene where Shelley auditions for Jason Schwartzman.
It's going to be a no for the day.
I mean, you can just write somebody off like that? This is how it works?
This is how auditioning works. Thank you. Bye, Sherry. Next.
I worked really hard. Please. Please, I worked really, really hard.
You know what? I can tell you worked really hard, and I'm sorry. It's just, if you were a really good dancer, it would be different. But your technique isn't great, okay? You were obviously hired at the Razzle Dazzle because you were beautiful and young a long time ago. I mean, this isn't news to you, is it? Maybe if you'd had some training or you'd been with a company in New York, you might have an argument here, but I mean, let's be honest. You were hired because you were sexy and you were young. I don't know how to help you if you don't understand, that's not what you're selling anymore, baby. Next.
Jason Schwartzman there and Pamela Anderson as Shelley. So, Justin, we know the way the substance goes. It goes into horror to make its point about female aging and the industries, the various agencies that they're in. Where does The Last Showgirl go?
You know, it's funny. It simultaneously is uplifting and breaks your heart all sort of at the same time. You know, she finally, I guess, recognizes the character Shelley recognizes she's going to have to move on. And like, maybe it's going to be as a waitress. You know, maybe there's something sort of else out there. But there's kind of this bittersweet moment she has with the Dave Bautista character, who, by the way, is also very, very good in this, where she's like, you know, because he's a union member stage manager. He has a pension. You know, he has these things that she doesn't have. And that this man behind the stage is taken care of. And she has really being discarded. So it's very hard not to feel that it's not a happy ending. Like, you're glad for her, but at the same time you really feel for an industry and for the people in that industry that are artists but aren't treated as such and are just so easily disposable.
Do you think it's a true slice of life?
It very much so speaks to the lack of supports and care in the US system. I mean, a lot of these women are working class women with nothing to fall back on. They're giving it their all. And again, if you're living paycheck to paycheck, you know, you're one medical industry, away from bankruptcy. So she has a very modest house that she's kind of worked for. And the reality is, and it's hinted at and implied there, that she will lose this. And meanwhile, her friend, who's played by Jamie Lee Curtis and who's also spectacular in this, she's suffering with gambling addiction. So she's gave up dancing. She moved into like cocktail waitressing. And now that's something that she's even being iced out of for the younger girls who are getting the longer shift. So she has nothing. Like, she has no money. She's a gambling addict in that space. And you really get how vulnerable all these women are. And I think the one beauty in it is the resilience that they form a bond. And they're not necessarily likable women. They're not great victims. They're angry. They're in pain. And that shows through all the time. They're not always kind to one another. But that surrogate family that they form is probably the one thing that they do have.
So stars out of five from you, Gemma, for the Last Showgirl.
I think four. It's brilliant. The one thing is that it does lack plot. It's a little bit experimental, so it wouldn't be to everybody's taste if you're expecting something that's very like classical and satisfying. But I just thought it was really, all the elements were amazing and the budget was so low. Like, what it was achieved on was incredible. So I did four.
From you, Justin.
Yeah, no, four stars as well. I mean, yeah, there's a real kind of documentary feel, especially, you know, there's scenes of her walking around the Las Vegas being dismantled for the super resorts and the super casinos. And it really feels like they just got out of a car and kind of filmed it on an iPhone. Like, it has that really gritty reality that just works so well with the content of the film. So, yeah, it's very good. Four stars.
Four stars from both of you. And our second and final film this evening is Vermilio, is how I'm pronouncing this Italian town. It's set in the Italian Alps, close to Germany, in 1944, as two soldiers return from the war, but they don't get the reception they're hoping for. There's an awful lot of beauty in this film, isn't there, Justin? And there's a strong plot as well. But I think it's the beauty and the beauty of the filmmaking and the time everything is given.
Yeah, no, it's definitely an homage to slow filmmaking. And it starts in the winter in the Alps, and, you know, all the buildings are whitewashed too. So it's these fir trees and, the grey mountains. But the way everything is just framed, it's framed like a postcard and just, you know, with somebody just moving through it. So, you know, the children, there's this family of 8 kids and the parents, just them going to church, just trekking through the snow. And they just sort of let everything happen. It's like they're on the way to the scene that you're going to get next. And it just gives you time to really look around and see the world that they're in. And it has this real timeless quality because it's obviously this intersection of pre-war, you know, Italian traditions in this mountain village, and it's all going to change when the war ends. And, you know, when you see the first bus after the war is over, it's a real shock because you almost feel like you've been in the 19th century. Like it's so detailed and rich. And that's all drawn from the director, who's really based all these little vignettes on her own family histories and stories told around the table.
So the story is about two soldiers who are coming back from the war, and it's questionable whether they've run away from the Germans to save their lives or if they've actually deserted.
Yeah, so I think they are two deserters, and very much so. The community plays as much of a character in this as the lead character of the families that we follow, because they'll often make a little comment about the deserting nature, about you know what's happening in the war, about maybe what people should be doing and shouldn't be doing, and that kind of flippant comment really works. It's very natural, but you get a sense of the community is as important here. So they return. Cesar, who is he's the school teacher, he reluctantly takes them into his enormous family and lets them sleep in his very dilapidated barn in the middle of winter. Pietro, who is from Sicily originally, and you know, he's there and he's very quiet and he's shell-shocked and he's uncomfortable, and like that he's very much seen as an outsider in the community. And Lucia, the daughter, takes a shine to him and starts to reach out to him. So they're like part of the story, even though it's sort of framed in the description of it as this is the narrative. That's one section of this entire family's lives that we're brought on this beautiful journey with. And this, the film itself is told in four seasons. And, you know, the first is the middle of winter. That's when they get to know one another. That's when everything is set up. It's very, very harsh. And you see how for this community who live off the land, you know, food in these times are scarce. There's sick children. There's a lot of rituals. There's a lot of habits and things that really kind of bring everybody together. So these two soldiers do really disrupt that. And you see, you know, the toll it takes on the people as they go through. But again, like it's not a huge toll. It's not a dramatic film full of conflict, more just tiny natural journeys.
But Justin, we see life in the village as well. And you talked about the teacher, Gemma, who's the father, and he's kind of the most important person in the village. Mm-hmm. And he shows great cruelty to some of his children and to his wife.
Yeah, no, with the children, they only have money for one to go on to school. So he's the primary school teacher. And it's sort of fabulous because you have like the 5-year-olds and his son is like 17, and he's kept failing him because he's not meeting his standards. So he's this huge kid at the back of the schoolroom with all these little kids in front of him. And he won't just give him the dignity of the primary school degree. But yeah, he has to decide who gets to go. And he's just very cruel, you know, though he recognizes parts of himself and all his daughters. It's the smart one, Flavia, who's going to get to go. And when his wife gives birth for the 10th time, she points out that he's never brought her flowers because the eldest son has. And he's just like, I can't believe you rebuked me in front of the children, and leaves. And that's just kind of the final world. So he has this menace under him. He never explodes and he never really threatens. But the feeling that he's in total control of his household is just palpable throughout.
Stars out of 5 from you, Gemma.
Oh, 4.5. I just think it's beautiful and it's so unique, and her voice is so strong, and what it says about womanhood and different generations and becoming a mother. There's just so much in there.
And from you, Justin.
Yeah, no, it's really good. I mean, you mentioned the Four Seasons. They use the music, the Four Seasons Vivaldi, really well throughout. But there's as much silence as dialogue in the movie, which is fascinating. 4.5. It's slow. It's on purpose. It's fascinating.
Well, two very good films to go and watch this weekend. My thanks to Jim McRae and Justin McGregor. The Last Showgirl goes on general release tomorrow, and Vermilio will be in selected cinemas, including the IFI, from the weekend. Next Thursday, the 6th of March, acclaimed pianist John O'Connor joins the RT Concert Orchestra and conductor Gavin Maloney for an evening of Beethoven, Brahms and Wagner at the National Concert Hall, Dublin. One element of the programme in particular, Beethoven's Fourth Piano Concerto, represents a kind of coming full circle for John. John O'Connor famously played the concerto in 1973 when he won the Beethoven International Piano Competition in Vienna, a prize that marked a major turning point in his career. I'm delighted that John O'Connor is on the line now from Winchester, Virginia in the US. It's not overstating the case, John, is it, to say that this concerto changed your life?
Oh, no, it's not at all. I mean, it was, I had no expectation of having a major international career before, and I was about to leave Vienna and come back and resume my teaching in Dublin. And my teacher in Vienna finally said to me, you know, I think you could have something special and you could have a major career. Why don't you do the International Beethoven Competition? And I loved the competition and I loved Beethoven. So
what did it involve, John, the competition? Were there various rounds where you had to perform?
Yes, there were four rounds. It started with 70 and then the second round, it was cut down to 36. That took a week. And then another week, it was cut down to 12 semifinalists and then finally down to three finalists in the Musikverein in Vienna.
And I know now that you were a concert goer there, but that you never had been on the stage previous to performing for the competition.
Well, I'd never had a seat. I was a penniless student. I mean, I was living on $75 a month, which I had to pay a flat, pay a rent, pay tuition and live. So I was very thin at the time. So I'd always been standing room at the back of the hall. So the first time I actually sat in the Musikverein was on stage at the final, which was quite an experience.
So let's listen now to the first movement with John O'Connor performing from Beethoven's symphony. There's the first movement from John O'Connor playing Beethoven's Fourth Piano Concerto. John, you're performing Beethoven's piano. You perform Beethoven's Piano Concerto number 3 here with the RT Concert Orchestra in 2023. How does the Piano Concerto number 4 compare with it?
Well, it's a different sort of concerto. I mean, the number 3 is very dramatic and the 4th can be dramatic, but it's also very lyrical. It has some beautiful phrases in it. And it's just an amazing beauty of the themes. He was more mature at the time and it's very special. It's one of the most famous piano concertos in the whole repertoire and people absolutely adore it.
And this is the one where the piano begins. Whereas
yes.
Usually it had been the tradition, the orchestra, and then there would be an opening for the piano.
That's right, yes. So this one, it actually starts with the piano itself, and then the orchestra joins in. So that was revolutionary as at the time. I mean, now it's, some people do the same thing now, but composers have done it since, but Beethoven was one of the first to do that.
And talk to me about the movements in this concerto.
Well, there are three movements. The first movement is perhaps the longest. It's very dramatic, very beautiful. And then the second movement is very gentle. It's an almost an argument between piano and orchestra. It starts with the orchestra being very loud, and then the piano comes in very quietly, and then the orchestra comes in loud again, and gradually the piano comes in gently again. It's almost, I've often said to students when I'm teaching it, you know, you have to imagine this is almost like a row between a husband and a wife. The husband starts shouting at the wife, and then the wife says, well, if you're going to talk to me like that, I won't be able to answer you. And then he starts shouting again, and then she says, well, I mean, if you're going to use that tone of voice, I'm not going to talk to you. And gradually he stops shouting, and he grumbles, and she becomes a little bit stronger. And that's the way the piano eventually conquers the orchestra in the second movement. And then the last movement is very lively and bounces around.
Well, let's hear the fighting couple movement. Here's a little from the second movement from Beethoven's fourth piano concerto. There, the second movement from the fourth piano concerto by Beethoven. Your relationship goes back so far now with Beethoven's music. Do you read a lot about Beethoven? Do you feel like very connected to him as a person, as a composer?
Yes, I've read voraciously about him. I mean, I've read just about every biography there is about him. I know an awful lot about the man. And it helped that my professor in Vienna looked a little bit like Beethoven. And we had great arguments about things. So, yeah, I've been very close to him. He's been very good to me. I play him a lot. In fact, I'm doing a recital in Ballon on the 10th of March when I'm home, and I'm going to be playing the Moonlight Sonata there, which is one of my favourites. I try and include Beethoven in my repertoire whenever I'm playing.
And do you see his life as a tragic life, or do you think, oh, for that gift, any tragedy is worth it?
I think it was a very difficult life. I mean, he was bullied by his father. He adored his mother, but she died when he was sort of, you know, very quite young. I think he always wanted to get married, but fell in love with all his female students, and daddy always thought marrying a musician, that sort of thing. So it was a very tragic, it was a very, very difficult life. But at the same time, he had a great sense of humour. People don't seem to realise that. And he was a very rounded person. I mean, he couldn't have written such a variety of extraordinary music without having a hugely wide personality.
Do you feel that working on the concertos with the orchestra, is that the pinnacle of what you like to do, or do you like doing the solo work?
Oh, I like both. I like both, but I mean, it's very special. I love playing with the RTE Concert Orchestra. I mean, the first time I ever played with orchestra was with the RTE Concert Orchestra when I was about 17. They gave me my first opportunity to play with orchestra. So I'm very close to them, and I think they have a great atmosphere amongst the orchestra. I mean, just rehearsing with them is fun, and being with them is fun. And so we toss around ideas, and playing with Gavin is also going to be great because I've played with him before and it's a great relationship.
Now, you're also going to be performing Brahms' First Symphony with the RTE Concert Orchestra. So this was a work that took him a long time to write.
Yes, yes. Well, I won't be playing in the Brahms Symphony, but it's a fabulous piece. I mean, he took a long time to actually decide to actually write a symphony, because he was so in awe of the nine symphonies of Beethoven that he took a long time to publish his first one. But this symphony is one of his greatest, and I think the
All right. Oh, your line just went there a bit. But John, we will audiences will be able to come and hear you with the RTE Concert Orchestra, conducted by Gavin Maloney, at the National Concert Hall in Dublin on the 6th of March. Further details from rte.ie/co. John O'Connor, thank you so much for talking to us.